we don't protect you. You don't get preferential treatment, access to our markets. And yeah, sure, we don't expect you to buy our treasuries. But if you dump them too quickly, we'll punish you. So that the world of a single reserve currency asset is probably ending.
What do you say to the people who maybe still dismiss gold as being old fashioned?
Well, it is old fashioned, and that's its strength. You know, it has been an asset that has been recognized around the world for 5,000 years in every culture and every period in history. So I think, if you like, that being old fashioned is actually its strength. So are the gold stocks cheap? I say, are they good value? Sorry. I think they are still good value. And have you missed the boat? Absolutely not. Now, clearly, if gold has a pause or drops for 20, you know, if gold has a correction, the gold stocks are going to give back a lot of those gains.
Good day. We have Adrian Day, a special guest here with me. Adrian Day is the founder and CEO of Adrian Day Asset Management. How are you, Adrian?
Well, I'm fine, thank you. And thank you for having me. Good to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Well, Adrian, you have been doing this for quite some time. You've been in the markets for decades. You've lived through booms. You've lived through busts. You lived through the bubbles. Mm-hmm. And you're still standing tall. And before we dive in, I would love to hear more about the Adrian Day Asset Management and to kind of hear some maybe stocks that you'd recommend a little bit. But I'd like to start by asking what kind of first drew you into the world of investing and eventually focusing on gold and natural resources?
Wow, that's an interesting question. Well, it's interesting to me, maybe not to anyone else. You know, I was always very interested in history. And I actually studied history at the London School of Economics, which was great, because the day I walked into that class, there were six of us sitting around a table with a teacher.
Yeah.
And other than a few lectures like economic history and European history, everything else was just the six of us with a teacher. So, I mean, you don't get that kind of experience in most US universities, I don't think. So anyway, that's a tangent. So I was always interested in history, and I was particularly interested in 19th century history, which obviously led me partly to the gold standard. And so I was really interested in the gold standard. And as a kid, believe it or not, you know, I walked into Sphinx, a famous coin dealer on the Strand in London, in my short pants and school blazer, and wanted to buy a Gold Britannia coin when I was like 12. I don't think they were very amused when they saw me walk in. But anyway, gold was my first investment. And I guess, just to simplify, it's a fairly short line to go from an interest in gold and the gold standard to gold stocks. And, you know, I started writing for other people's newsletters. And, well, first of all, I started as an editor, and then I started writing, frankly, without knowing much about it. But I was actually horrified by the number of people that would turn good investment recommendations into bad ones, or bad ones into worse ones. By which I mean, let's say I recommended a stock in a newsletter, a little penny stock in Australia at 12 cents. And 6 months later, I recommended people sell it at 8 cents because it hadn't worked out. You know, 2, 3, 4 years later, people would say, "What do you think about XYZ?" I said, "Well, we sold it. I don't follow it." "Didn't you sell it?" "Oh, I saw your recommendation, but I, you know, you seem so keen on it, I didn't want to sell it at a loss." And we had the same thing in reverse, but out of humility, I talk about the one that went down. And so after a while, I just saw, well, you know, for whatever reason, people, you know, emotions comes into this an awful lot. That's one of the things I really learned. Emotions. I don't want to take a loss. Or, man, it's doing so well. Let's just keep on going. And so after a while, I had a lot of people say, well, can you manage my money? Can you manage my money? And essentially, I just set up my own firm to manage other people's money.
I love it. Well, Adrian, thanks for that. I wanted to get you on. It's been an honor to follow you, but love to kind of hear your thoughts. The U.S. debt keeps climbing. The government does what it does best, which is spend beyond its means, and which always leads to more printing and easy money. And so I want to know, can the U.S. realistically continue? Can we grow out of this debt mountain, or are we just kicking the can until something breaks here?
No, I think the latter. And you're absolutely right. The astonishing thing is that there are various people in Congress, not many, but there are various people in Congress who in varying degrees are concerned about the deficit and spending. I mean, there's obviously people like Ron Paul and Massey who are, you know, very, very concerned about it and vote against even continuing resolutions. But what tends to happen in Congress, as you probably know, and we saw this with the so-called Big Beautiful Bill. You have a bill in the House that raises spending only by less, I don't know the number, let's say it only raises spending by 5%. Then it goes over to the Senate and they have a bill but only raises spending by 5%. But there's different things they want to spend on than the House. So then the House and Senate get together to reconcile a bill, and guess what? Everybody's spending gets approved. So now in reconciliation, you suddenly have a 10% or a 7% increase in spending. And of course, that's before you even get to the initial sort of jockeying where I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine. Hey, you know, approve this new building in my district and I'll approve your extension of food stamps, which you seem so keen on. And so that's just the way it gets done, is that there's very little, because I exempt people like Rand Paul and Tom Massey. There's very little willingness to actually cut spending, and particularly when it comes to, quote, hard decisions. And as you know, very little of the U.S. federal budget is discretionary spending. Most of it is fixed spending. And a majority, and the biggest item of fixed spending is entitlements. And unless you tackle entitlements, no, you're never going to have a balanced budget. You're never going to have a balanced budget unless you tackle entitlements. And it shows an incredible lack of statesmanship, if you like. No one's ever accused congressmen of being statesmen, but it's an incredible lack of statesmanship to refuse to tackle entitlements when certainly it could have been done quite painlessly, you know, 30 years ago. Now, do you mind if I go on a tangent, or you can cut it out if you want?
So no, please, please.
You know, when the Social Security, and this is so typical of things in all government, frankly, happens in Britain, it happens in the US. You know, when Social Security was introduced right after the war, the average male life expectancy was less than 2 years beyond the age when you could start receiving Social Security. Now, of course, it's more like 20 years. And so instead of raising the age at which you take Social Security, they're afraid to do that. And so they've just let this thing balloon out of all proportion and out of what it was originally intended for, which was it was intended, you know, for people who retire. You don't want in a rich country, you just don't want older people to be destitute. So we give them a minimum standard. And it's not originally, and originally, of course, it was meant to be an insurance program. You pay in all your life, and what you get out of it when you retire is actually based on the number of years that you were working. So if you only worked for 3 years and took the time off to lie on the beach the rest of the time, what you got was much less than the person who had worked and paid in for 45 years. So it was an insurance program, but it was run by the government. And as always with things that are run by the government, you know, they just get out of control because there's no incentive. There's no incentive to control costs. No one gets rewarded for making the program more efficient. No one gets punished for making it more inefficient. And so you have fraud. And fraud in Social Security is fairly widespread, but is by no means the biggest part of a problem. You have other things added on, like disability. Now, we can argue whether a person who's disabled and unable to work should get paid by the government. Maybe they should. We'll leave that argument aside. But it's not meant to be part of a Social Security insurance program. And then on top of that, of course, as always, when you have, you can get paid for being disabled and not being able to work, you don't need to go through some heavy, you don't need to show up at a government agency where they test you to see whether you're able to work. You just get a doctor's note. Not so difficult, unfortunately. So that in Britain, for example, which has similar sort of thing, you have over 25% of the adult males who are on disability. Anyway, let's just leave that aside. So to get back to, sorry, I do go on.
It's okay. I'm enjoying this.
Let's pull it back in. And so, yeah, you said, will they balance the budget and stop spending, or will they just kick the can down the road? Obviously, the second. Now, the US is in a unique situation where, as the world's, with the dollar as the world's reserve currency, it has been able to print far more money than is needed for its own domestic needs, knowing that that money will always be consumed or will always be demanded, wanted by other countries around the world. And that means that the US has been able to spend beyond its means, and Americans don't understand that, because it was the same in Britain in the 30s, well, 40s was the war, of course, where countries frequently spend beyond their means, but people don't realize that, and export inflation. So the inflation is basically exported. That era is probably coming to an end. I'm not suggesting that another currency will replace the dollar anytime soon. You know, that's been the big debate, if you like, or the big subject for the last 20 years. You know, yeah, the dollar's this, the dollar's that, but what's going to replace it? Well, we're now seeing that maybe nothing is going to replace it, or not so much nothing, but no one single currency is just going to replace the dollar. But, you know, we're heading into this bipolar or multipolar world. And some of the people around Trump in the Mar-a-Lago, what's generally called the Mar-a-Lago Accord, some of the people, in, you know, who've written for that, like Steve Maron, who's now on the Federal Reserve Board, Steve Bannon, who's not in the administration, he was in the last one, but he's still influential. Mm-hmm. They've written about how there's the U.S. sphere and there can be the Chinese sphere. And in the U.S. sphere, the U.S. will help defend you. You get preferential access to our markets. We expect you to buy our treasuries. And in the Chinese sphere, we don't protect you. You know, if you want to go with China, let them protect you. We don't protect you. You don't get preferential access to our markets. And yeah, sure, we don't expect you to buy our treasuries. But if you dump them too quickly, we'll punish you. So the world of a single reserve currency asset is probably ending. And what I would say, and I'll stop here, what I would say is that to the extent that the US dollar loses its sole dominance as a reserve currency, then to that extent, countries will start, first of all, not buying dollars, and secondly, selling the dollars. And to that extent, then some of that money will go into gold, the dollar will lose its value against other currencies, and inflation will pick up. Long answer, but and that's something that's been going on for 25 years, but it's probably coming to a head fairly soon.
Adrian, I had someone on here, he said that one day everyone's going to be, we might come to a day, maybe in our lifetime, where everyone's a millionaire, but a can of Coke costs $20. That's a scary picture, but yeah. How worried should investors be? Are we going to reach the point where the Fed can't keep printing money? Is there a day of reckoning ahead? And like, what might that look like for an everyday American?
Yeah, no, good question. I'm not suggesting we're going to get runaway inflation any day soon. I'm certainly not suggesting that, because the US is not going to totally lose its reserve currency status. It's just going to be shared with other people. So, you know, when you look at reserve currency status, you're primarily looking at two things. To what extent is the dollar used in global trade, but doesn't affect the US? And secondly, to what extent is it a reserve asset of primarily central banks, but frankly also other banks? Now, on the first, on the trade, you know, the US is still the dominant currency in which people conduct trade. It's losing it a little bit, but at the margin, like Brazil and Russia will have an agreement, you know, to buy Russian oil in rubles or something, and Saudi Arabia and China will have an agreement that they'll conduct, they'll do their oil trading in a currency other than the US dollar. So it's losing it at the margin. The more dramatic thing is with the dollar as a reserve currency. You know, in 2000, yeah, well, 1999, at mm-hmm. 1999, the dollar was over 75%. It was about 78% of all central banks' foreign assets. And by foreign assets, I mean not the pound for the British bank, not the euro for the French bank, and so on. But all foreign assets, the dollar was 78% at the beginning of the decade. By 5 years ago, that had fallen to about 65%. Last year, it was 58%. Right now, it's at about 48%. That is a very, very dramatic decline in a reserve asset of central banks, which tend to move slowly. You know, central banks are not day traders. A very, very dramatic move. And I'll just make one point, if I may. I was talking to someone the other day, and we talked about the dollar and gold. What do you attribute it to? And he gave one word answer, which was Trump. And that, now, to me, I'm not going to get political, but to me, that's just nonsense. As I've just shown, the dollar reserves in central banks have been declining and declining steadily for 25 years. I will say that there's nothing that this administration is doing to arrest that decline, but it's something that predates them and is going to postdate them. Mm-hmm. And so I'll get to answering your question in a minute. And so the question is, originally, central banks started selling dollars because it was just too much concentration. 78% of your reserves in one asset is just too much concentration. It's particularly too much concentration if you're concerned about the fiscal situation of the US, which we are. And that concern has not really, it's not ameliorated at all in the last 25 years, as we were talking about earlier. And so the concern that you've got a country running huge fiscal deficits, right, as well as trade deficits, huge fiscal deficits, and we've got the majority of our reserves, that calls for diversification in any event. The founding of the euro helped because it meant you had a bigger currency that you were able to put some of your reserves into. Then, of course, you had the weaponization of the dollar, which again predated the current administration. I have to keep emphasizing that for people who want to blame Trump for everything that goes on in this world. And that predated 2022, frankly. It predated the confiscation of Russian reserves. We've had U.S. weaponization of the dollar increasingly, you know, for 10 years now. And I won't go into that, but we can if you want. And so...
petrodollar?
What?
The petrodollar.
Absolutely. And then, of course, when the U.S. weaponizes the SWIFT system to punish people who are doing legal things in their own country, but things that the U.S. doesn't like, and they punish them because the money went through the SWIFT system. So that is something that causes, and I'm referring there to the Spanish bank that made a loan to a construction company to build a hotel in Cuba, perfectly legal under Cuban law, under U.S., under Spanish law, under EU law, under UN sanctions, etc. But the U.S. didn't like it, so they punished, they fined the Spanish bank for the temerity of making a loan to a company to build a hotel in Cuba. And there's other examples like that. Anyway, so the point is, if you're concerned about concentration of an asset with it put out by a fiscally irresponsible country, and you're a little bit concerned to some degree or another about weaponization, and everyone is concerned about weaponization, it's not just, you know, North Korea and Yemen,
right?
But you know, the U.S. forced their way with the Swiss banks. I just mentioned the Spanish bank that was fined. Bank Paribas in France had a similar situation. So even friendly countries, to some extent or another, have that concern. Mm-hmm. So the question I ask is, if you're concerned about concentration of an asset put out by a fiscally irresponsible country where they might punish you, mm-hmm. what is too much? Is 48% too much? I would argue 48% is still too much. So we're going to continue to see, So we're going to continue to see this decline in the dollar in central bank reserves. Now, what does that mean? It means that if you think about it, all of the dollars that have ever been created since 1971 under the Bretton Woods system, or even before that, since 1945 under the Bretton Woods system, and since 1971 after the US broke away from the Bretton Woods system, finally broke the last vestige of a link, and the money printing went out of control, right, by Alan Greenspan back then, or soon after that by Alan Greenspan. All of those dollars, which were far in excess of the needs of the U.S. economy, that's important to remember, are still in existence. And they're in existence in central bank reserves. They're in existence in private bank reserves. But they're also in existence with, you know, the Colombian drug dealer. In the past, a Colombian drug dealer who got dollars for his assets didn't immediately turn around and exchange those dollars for pesos. He kept dollars, right? Saved in dollars. Same for Argentinians concerned about the collapse of the peso under other Peronists. The same for etc. You know, the same for and you could go around the world in the 70s and 80s and 90s and early 2000s. You go to a hotel in Thailand and get out dollar bills and they'll take them, right? You know that, you've traveled.
Yeah.
Used to be that way with the British pound. But can you imagine going to a hotel today and getting out some British pounds? You know, they'll laugh at you. What are these bits of funny paper? But that's important, and that's the lesson. But to the extent that the US loses that reserve status, and to the extent that people around the world no longer trust the dollar, then that those dollars are going to start being exchanged for other currencies. And when they're exchanged for other currencies, what happens to them? They come back into the US banking system. And so all of that excess money creation over the last 40 years is, and we've been able, US has been able to avoid the consequences and export the inflation, all those dollars will come back to the US. And that will lead to a long-term decline in the dollar's value and an increase in inflation. And the parallel is after the Second World War, 1945, Britain was bankrupt. It had just spent altogether too much money in the First World War and the Second World War. Franklin Roosevelt, remember, had the land lease program where the money was borrowed. Britain borrowed the money from the US. Now, thank you, Americans, for the troops and everything else. But on a financial, and I mean that sincerely, sorry.
Yeah.
That wasn't flippant.
No,
but,
no.
But on a financial basis, people forget Roosevelt lent the money to Britain. Britain had to pay it back. And in 1945, Britain was bankrupt and couldn't pay it back. And so Britain lost its reserve status. And look what happened to the British pound. It went from 5 to 1. I mean, you know, the British pound used to be worth $5. And by the time Margaret Thatcher came in, 25 years later, it was 1 to 1.
Yeah.
Huge decline in the purchase, in the value of the pound. And in the 1960s, Britain, which used to, you know, rule a third of the world, had to go cup in hand to the International Monetary Fund for a loan. So, and people say, oh, well, that's Britain. This is America. Yeah, but in 1890, I can tell you, people said, this is Britain and that's America. So things change. And you know, I think we're certainly going to see a long-term decline in the value of the dollar, intermittently ups and downs, of course, and we're going to see a pickup in inflation. And you know, I don't think we'll see the real impact of inflation maybe for a couple of years, because obviously if you head into a recessionary period, that acts as a damper on inflation, obviously, because if people don't have the money to spend, then you have less demand and the same number of goods, initially the same number of goods.
Yeah.
So, you know, economics 101, less money chasing more goods means the price of the goods goes down. So, and I believe we're heading into a recessionary period or certainly a significant economic slowdown. So I don't expect inflation to run away from us in the next year or two. But as we know, you know, inflation compounds on itself. So people look and say, oh, yeah, we had this little bump in COVID, but now it's back to, you know, just a little over 2%. Isn't life wonderful? Well, if you look at the years from January 2020 to January 2024, which... January 21 to January 25, which not coincidentally are the years of the Biden administration, the CPI, according to the government's own numbers, different subject, how accurate they are. But according to the government's own numbers, the CPI went up over 22% over those 4 years. And we only had inflation above 5% once. So it compounds on itself.
Adrian, what, I mean, you've been a big advocate of gold and, you know, and it's had a solid run. And so in this day and age, in a world where debt's getting out of control, money printing, currency wars, digital currency, what role does gold play now? And what do you say to the people who maybe still dismiss gold as being old fashioned?
Well, it is old fashioned, and that's its strength. You know, it has been an asset that has been recognized around the world for 5,000 years in every culture and every period in history. So I think, if you like, that being old fashioned is actually its strength. I think the thing that we must recognize as investors is that the drivers of gold for the last 3 years has not been investment demand, whether it's central banks, whether it's wealthy families concerned about fiscal irresponsibility and wanting a defensive asset, whether it's non-official Chinese buying concerned about the devaluation of the yuan and a little bit concerned about the stability of the banking system and not wanting to get into real estate, which will be a traditional hedge or a traditional hedge. Understandably not wanting to get into real estate and not allowed to get into crypto. But these drivers are not what I call traditional investment demand. And other than the non-official Chinese, they would tend to be fairly inelastic demand. In other words, the Central Bank of Poland doesn't say, gold's down $2 today. Why don't we buy some gold? Because looking at the Fibonacci numbers and the cup and handle, it might go up next week. No, they say we want to buy gold as a strategic asset. And the price, it's like buying insurance. Yes, you shop around to get a good deal, but if you're living in a floodplain, you don't say, I don't think we'll buy inflation, not this year. Let's wait till prices come down. No, of course not. You buy the insurance, and that's what's happening. So the price is very inelastic. And I think that demand is going to continue to go up. And investors who are not into gold yet, and as we know, the moves into the gold ETFs and other indicators would suggest that the public is certainly not rushing into gold. If you look at this year, the GLD, for example, and other gold ETFs have certainly had inflows, but certainly no rush of inflows. And if you talk to coin dealers, they'll tell you they're so busy, but they have as many calls with people wanting to sell their gold as buy their gold. Mm-hmm. I think if people are not invested in gold at this point, that's a huge mistake, because investors are going to turn to gold at some point, and they typically turn to gold when in North America, where we don't have this long history of using gold as an asset of last resort. You know, in Switzerland, in Germany, with the Weimar still fresh in people's minds. Same in France, of course. They remember, same in Vietnam. People remember what gold can actually do for you in terms of, forget it going up in price, but just being able to survive or leave the country and start a new life or whatever. We don't have that in the US or Canada. So we tend to buy gold based purely on investments. Well, the investment scenario that is most attractive for gold is a declining economy, low and declining interest rates to the point where they become negative real rates, high and rising inflation, and a declining dollar. Well, we haven't had that. That hasn't been the case for the last 3 years. Certainly the narrative has not been that. But it's slowly turning in that direction. You know, you can't ignore the signs of a declining economy, particularly the labor market in the US. Inflation is well above, after a stabilized from the decline from COVID, it is above, it's above where it was before COVID. Mm-hmm. For 5 years before COVID, inflation was never as high as it is now. And it's also above the central bank's arbitrary 2% target. So inflation is by no means, and remember that the Federal Reserve in particular has been trying to get inflation down. That's been their number one objective until just the last couple of months. So if you're trying to get inflation down and it is still above your own target, that suggests that inflation is a lot more stubborn than most people recognize. And then the dollar, of course, has had a huge decline this year, and we've already talked about the dollar. So what I'm saying is that the economic environment is slowly shifting towards an environment that is attractive for gold. And investors are going to start pouring in when those inflation numbers pick up.
Adrian, you've been a value investor where, you know, the world loves momentum, and, you know, the gold's been on a tear. So, you know, in terms of staying disciplined when markets get noisy, and then also understanding the need for gold and the environment we live in, how do you, where do you see gold merely as fire insurance? Do you see something as inevitably something that has to go up because the dollar will continue to go down? Is it too late to jump on the gold wagon, or is it something we got to be careful about?
No, but that's an excellent, excellent question. I mean, first of all, gold is insurance. Yeah, you should be fairly price inelastic and not be overly concerned about the price that you're paying. But gold, I'll say gold in quotes, gold assets, including the equities as an investment, you obviously do want to be concerned about price. Now, what I'll say is that if you look at the gold stocks, what are they? The XAUs up over 100% this year to date. So for a value investor, the immediate reaction would be a little bit of caution. But remember, Oscar Wilde told us to look at value, not at price. And if you look at the value of the gold stocks, they are actually no more, they're certainly not overvalued. And on most metrics, most gold stocks are trading at valuations that are below their long-term average. And in some cases, far below their long-term averages. And a good example, if I may, would be Agnico Eagle, which is without question the gold standard of major gold miners. And I use Agnico because nobody accuses you of, you know, if you pick Barrick, they'll say, oh, well, yeah, that's cheap because of Pakistan. And Bristow's just been fired, and Mali and everything else. But if you look at Agnico, you know, there's no hairs on that dog, as they say. And if you look at their price to free cash flow today, I mean, certainly high, it's like 38 times. But gold stocks always trade at high multiples, remember that. That's higher than it was at the beginning of the year. But it is actually lower than it has been for every other year of the last 5 years. Think about that. Agnico Eagle, whose stock price has more than doubled this year, and it's quadrupled in the last 5 years, is trading at lower multiples today than it was in 2023, 2022, 2021, 2020. So are the gold stocks cheap? I say, are they good value? Sorry. I think they are still good value. And have you missed the boat? Absolutely not. Now, clearly, if gold has a pause or drops for 20, you know, if gold has a correction, the gold stocks are going to give back a lot of those gains. But it's interesting, you look at from April to beginning of August when gold was basically flat, right? Or in fact, yeah, from end of April to pretty much the third week of August, gold was absolutely flat. And what happened to gold stocks during that period? They actually went up marginally. So I think you need gold to actually correct for the gold stocks to decline. And you know, the way I'm handling it for new investors, if a new investor comes to me and he has gold, he wants gold, right? That's what he wants.
Yeah.
I always ask how much gold he's already got. And I always ask what percentage of his investment portfolio, this money that he's allocating to gold, represents. And if a person is allocating 10 or 20% to gold and they're not already overloaded, I go ahead and I invest most of that money right away. Now, if they're giving me 50% of their money for gold and they've already got a bunch of physical gold sitting in a vault somewhere, we will invest. But I always like to keep some money back in reserve, both in case the market corrects, which I think is less likely, but just for specific stocks. You know, specific stocks pull back for different reasons. A good example, if I may, would be Orla. You know, Orla is a company that I had a really good meeting with the people in Beaver Creek up at the Gold Conference at the middle of September. I really like the story. You know, like the people, like the mines, like the growth plans, like the balance sheet, really liked it. I just came away saying this is just too expensive to chase. Mm-hmm. And then about a week later, Newmont decided to sell all of the shares that they owned in the company in an overnight offering. They did it at a 10% discount. And as often happens when a big seller, you know, does an overnight with a discount, how does the stock open the next day? Well, the stock goes right down to the price of that offering. And as normally happens, and did in this case, it actually goes below it. So investors were able to buy Orla at, you know, 13% below where it had been the week before. So you always need to have some cash in reserve to be on the lookout for those kind of opportunities. But I don't think people have missed it by any, that's the fundamental message, sorry, is mm-hmm. that people have not missed it at all, not in the least. The gold stocks are inexpensive, the margins are growing, meaning the free cash flow is growing, which means that so long as gold doesn't collapse, the valuations are going to get it only better. And then the most important thing is that this is not a crowded trade at the moment. It's possibly overbought, but underowned, significantly mm-hmm. underowned. And if you look at, mm-hmm. for example, the GDX, even in the last month, we've had net outflows. I mean, that's astonishing. Yep. Net outflows from the GDX in the last month. And year to date, the net outflows are about 3.7 billion. So the public is not in this sector at all. By the public, I mean not gold investors like you and me, not sophisticated investors like Ray Dalio. You know, he's not going to buy the GDX, I don't think. You know, people who do their own homework and decide what stocks to buy. But the generalist investor who uses the GDX to get his exposure to gold is clearly not in this market.
Adrian, are there other natural hard assets, mining, energy stuff that you see as maybe one of the best opportunities and resources right now? I mean, any other sectors, gold, copper, uranium, rare earth, that's, I know that you're all about valuation. So anything that's kind of underappreciated at this point?
Well, I think the whole complex is undervalued. If you look at commodities themselves plus resource equities mm-hmm. relative to financial assets, so for example, relative to the Dow, they're trading at essentially 100-year lows. They've moved a little bit off the bottom, but they're essentially at 100-year lows. So as a value investor, that at least makes me want to look. And again, you know, some of these sectors are very, very out of favor. Oil, of course, is a classic one that's out of favor. It used to represent 20 years ago, it was like 16% of the S&P was in oil stocks, the big majors primarily. Now it's, I think, 2.5%, just one stock is in oil. So very, very underowned and very, in certain sectors, hated, but even in sectors that don't hate it, even among people that don't hate it, they're very, very cautious of oil. But I think all of the sectors are undervalued. For me, the ones I focus primarily on are the ones where there is a potential supply shortage in addition to possible demand growth. Now, obviously, prices are always a combination of the supply and demand, right? Obviously, as well as the stockpiles that you have sitting around. But if you have strong reasons to think that the supply is going to have difficulty keeping up with an increased demand, then that's where I'm more focused on. So in other words, more focused on copper than I am on iron ore. There's no shortage of iron ore. There's a shortage of high quality of iron ore, but you know, if push came to shove, there's enough low grade, low quality, environmentally damaging iron ore to fill all the supply needs, all the demand needs that you could possibly want. But that's not true of copper. It's not true of uranium. And those are really the areas where and it's not true of silver. Those are the areas where I'm more heavily focused on.
Adrian, I've learned so much. If I could just ask one more question on kind of just to pick your brain, what would you say if you could sum up your philosophy in one or two sentences? And is there any hint in terms of investing, like the mistakes that you commonly see, especially since you've lived through the booms, busts, and bubbles, like what's the one hint, one tip you can give for investors? And then I would love to ask about your asset management as well. But
okay. And I'm happy for you to ask other questions because probably you'll want to cut some of my rambling earlier.
No, so it's great. I'm enjoying it.
Well, we're value investors. I describe myself, my approach as being long-term global value. And I like to find what I regard as good quality companies, and we could spend an hour talking about what's good quality, but good quality companies that are selling at good valuations. And if I find such a good company, and it might be a new company, like an Origin Royalty, or it might be a huge company like Nestle that has dropped significantly. If I find one of those, we will hold that stock until either the valuation gets excessive or the company changes its business model and I no longer like it. You know, we're not day traders. I'm not betting on the next drill hole. You know, I'm looking for long-term, I'm looking to build a collection of really great companies, over time, preferably because we're not day traders, preferably the pay dividends, and global because, you know, just because it's foolhardy, I believe, to exclude, even if you're a U.S. person with the strong biggest economy in the world, just about, but still the biggest economy in the world, certainly the largest stock market in the world, it's still foolhardy to exclude 30 or 40% of the world. You know, I often say it's a bit like saying, well, I only buy companies whose names begin with A to M because there's plenty of opportunities in those names. I hear this all the time. Oh, we don't need to look abroad. There's plenty of opportunities in the US. But, you know, there's plenty of opportunities outside the US. And right now, they are a lot more undervalued in general than the equities in the US. So that's the general approach. I'm not afraid to hold cash. Cash for me is not an allocation, but it's sort of what's left over if I don't find good things to, you know, spend the money on. Now, obviously, we have sort of a vague allocation to, I don't want to go over, you know, I don't want to go over 12% in Hong Kong, for example, and we're not at 12%, but I don't want to go over 12. I don't want to go, you know, over 15 in Europe, and we're not at 15 yet. But I don't have an allocation for gold, for cash. I mean, I don't have an allocation for cash. It's really what's left over when I can't find things to buy. I don't know if that's enough on that. Mistakes. Oh my gosh, I've made enough. I think your listeners are most interested in gold and the commodities, right? So I think the biggest mistake, is that right or not?
Yes, but I would love to hear Adrian Day unfiltered. How's that?
On what? Silver.
Let's hear Adrian Day unfiltered. Just tell me what you would normally tell anybody.
Yeah. Well, I certainly think, let me just finish my thought, Devo, but in terms of resources, we must remember, notwithstanding everything I've said before, that resources are inherently volatile. I mean, I think we're at the bottom of a cycle now, but they are inherently volatile, and the bull markets don't last forever. And they're short-term volatile as well. So you have to be, if you're investing, you should invest in the resource sector to the extent that you are not only financially able to withstand volatility, you know, which means don't invest 100%, because I guarantee you the day you want $5,000 to fix your car is the day that the sector will be down. So invest financially appropriately, but also emotionally, because there are some people who simply cannot tolerate emotionally sudden big losses. And you will get those in the sector. Mm-hmm. So again, don't over-invest. I mean, in different periods, not in the last year or two, thank goodness, but in different periods, I've had clients call me and say, Aiden, I just can't stand any more of this. I can't sleep at night. And as often as not, they've got too much in the one sector. You know, if you have 10% exposed to gold stocks and you believe everything I've just said, you're not going to be worried if they pull back 25% next month. It's not going to concern you. But if you've got everything fully invested, well, yeah, you're going to freak out, if I can use that expression, if they drop, you know, 25 or 30% in a month. So right size it for financial, but also emotional circumstances. I think one of the biggest mistakes that a lot of investors make, particularly younger people today, is the feel that they have to be doing something. And you remember the great Charlie Munger, great investor, the sidekick, the right-hand man of Warren Buffett, he used to say that most of my time is spent deciding not to do anything. You know, if you've bought a great company and the price is still right, you don't need to do anything. But people always feel, gosh, you know, unless they do anything, then they're not really. And I say this to some of my clients, if a client calls and says, particularly ones with smaller accounts, obviously, gosh, did you forget about me? You haven't done a trade in 6 months. I said, would you like me just to sell something for the fun of it? I mean, we own Franco and Agnigo and Altius. We own great companies. Which one would you like me to sell? Well, I didn't mean that. So, I mean, sometimes doing nothing is actually the right thing to do. And we have so much information, so much data these days, that there's a natural tendency to react to data. Now, first of all, investors should try never to react. You should always be proactive, not reactive. Mm-hmm. And don't forget, if you read about it in the newspaper, it's too late, because by then everybody knows.
Yeah.
But some of the greatest investors, like Warren Buffett, like John Templeton, well, John Templeton, of course, retired before the internet came along, but they don't have Bloomberg terminals sitting on their desk. They're not looking at the price of something all day long, because that just makes you go crazy and think you've got to do something.
Adrian, if people want to know more about what you do, want to get a hold of you, want maybe some help sorting through all the data and being more proactive instead of reactive, if you can just tell us where to find you, how to get a hold of you.
Yeah, well, the website is adrianday.com, so that's easy. And we have a newsletter as well as a money management. They're separate businesses. And then I'm happy if people want to email us. It's assetmanagement@adrianday.com. Or actually on the website I just mentioned, there's a, you know, you can go there and just click on the link to send a question.
So you have adrianday.com and adrianassetmanagement.com?
No. Sorry. It's adrianday.com. That's the website. Awesome. I was giving you the email address, assetmanagement@adrianday.com.
Okay. And what's the email address?
assetmanagement@adrianday.com.
Awesome. Well, Adrian, I enjoyed it. Thank you for sharing your thoughts and love learning from you. So I appreciate the time. I know that the listeners will benefit as well. So hope to have you on the show again. I've got so many more questions.
No, I would love to, Stephen. Please ask me back. And next time I won't ramble so much. Next time.
No, we love to ramble. We love the Adrian Day Unfiltered. That's where the good stuff is. So thank you for the gold mines, and we'll be in touch. Thanks, Adrian.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you.
Bye-bye.